Our next speaker is our own Dr. Alan Auden. He's a professor of educational administration in the School of Education from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's co-director of the Consortium for Policy Research and Education, a consortium of the University of Wisconsin-Madison and universities at Harvard, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Stanford. Now, sometimes professors are criticized for spending too much time in the ivory tower. But let me describe the record of this professor, who I think we can safely say has taken the elevator down from the ivory tower. And he's worked on education finance and teacher compensation projects in over 20 states. He's consulted with governors, state legislatures, chief state school officers, Congress, with departments of education in England and Australia. He's published 25 books and monographs. He has over 200 publications, if you include all of his journal articles and book chapters, articles in trade publication and research reports. He served as president of the American Education Finance Association in the early 90s, recently received their Distinguished Service Award. Perhaps most surprising is that Dr. Auden has contributed to the economic development of the state. Since 1990, I added up on his CV, he brought in over $39 million in grants. And I know that Dr. Auden will not drop the ball today because he tells me that he's coached youth soccer. And I know that he'll stay on track because he collects Lionel trains. And I know that when he makes a commitment, he'll follow through. He's been married to his wife for 38 years. So without further ado, let me introduce to you Dr. Alan Auden. His talk today, School Performance and Funding.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. When I look out in the audience, I'm kind of a local boy talking about school finance issues, but there are probably a dozen school finance experts in the audience, so hopefully we'll all get into a dialogue on these issues. I think the major introductory comment I want to make is that John and I had dark hair when we started working on school finance and school finance adequacy several years ago, so it does take a toll. And I'm going to try to bring some of these issues down to Wisconsin, and I'll begin just trying to set a context with some Wisconsin numbers on kind of our spending, teacher salaries, performance, some changes over time, and then I'll get into these finance issues. And here you've got some numbers on kind of expenditures per pupil, changes over several decades from 1960 to the year 2000. And when you look at these numbers, let's see, that might be a little clear. From 1960 to 1990, spending per pupil in Wisconsin tripled, went up 200%. This is per pupil adjusted for inflation. And it went up at about that level nationally as well. For the entire 21st century, from about 1900 to 1990, there was a continuous increase in dollars per pupil all over the country. The increase slowed, as you can see, in the 1990s, but even when we had our cost controls in that year, Wisconsin increases still kind of beat the increases nationally. So if you look over a long time period, we've been a function that has been getting more and more money, except until recently. Now here are the actual numbers. They're pretty healthy. The column on the right shows the advantage of Wisconsin in terms of spending per pupil over the national average. We were above the national average in 81, and our kind of premium over the national average has continued to grow over the past two decades. And in the year 2003, according to the data set I had, Wisconsin spent on average, state, local, and federal, $9,232 a kid, which is, you know, a decent bundle of money, and that gave us 18% over the national average. I think we kind of rank about 12. But the point is, we may need more money, but we're not like a lot of other states. I'm working in Arizona. They spend $5,000 a kid. So from the perspective of Arizona, we're really wealthy. From our own perspective, we'd like a little bit more, but we're at a fairly high level. If you look at teacher salaries, there's somewhat of a different story. The teacher salary story is that while salaries have gone up, these are numbers unadjusted for inflation, the difference between Wisconsin teacher salaries and the national average, we had about a 4.5% advantage in 1986, and it's kind of been going down ever since. And my guess is the QEO has kind of hit here. And in 2003, Wisconsin is 7% below the national average in average teacher salaries. And my guess is until we do something about the QEO, and I know that's a, you know, it raises a large number of issues, that, that those trends probably will remain. Now, the last chart here that I'm going to put in just in terms of context is our performance, and I decided to use numbers that give us data versus a more national performance standard, and that's really the National Assessment of Educational Progress. In Wisconsin, there was a question about standards. The performance standards across the states are different. Some states have very tough performance standards. Some states have kind of like average performance standards. We're kind of more in that moderate area. Some states have easy performance standards. So if when you ask the question, what percentage of our kids meet or beat the performance standards, when you have easy standards, a higher percentage meet or beat them than when you have tough standards. But the National Assessment of Educational Progress kind of lays a common standard across all states. And what you see here is this is the percentage of kids at or above the proficiency standards in fourth and eighth grade mathematics and reading. And the results show that we're better than the national average. And a lot of Wisconsin people talk about that a lot. We're better than the national average. And it kind of makes us kind of satisfied and kind of, in a sense, sanctimonious. But when you say, how much above the national average? We're just a little bit above the national average. And when you say, well, is the national average very good? The answer is no. Because only 30% of the national average kids performed to proficiency. So that, yes, we're better. A national average has to kind of like more than triple to get all their kids up to or above. We have to only triple or just slightly less than triple. So the point here is that versus a common standard, we have a lot of progress to make in terms of what Heather was saying, in terms of getting more and more kids up to an acceptable 21st century performance standard. So the point here is that we've got a decent amount of money. We're way above the national average. Our performance is a little bit above the national average. In order to get, let's say, 90% of kids at the national average, we have to increase performance by about 150% at least, to make closer to 200%. And we're not going to get 200% more money. And what it means is we're going to have to squeeze more performance out of our current dollars and squeeze more performance out of any new dollars we might get over time. Here's the context conclusion. Now I want to get into finance. And this is, it's hopefully getting it twice from John and me, some of the key issues will sink in. But this is kind of a quick summary of what John said. Finance focused on equity pretty much up until 1990. And equity was, did District A have more than District B? And did they have more because they had more wealth? As standards-based education reform hit, and as the state role in school funding rose, like it did in Wisconsin, and got to a fairly high level in the 90s, people began to ask, justifiably, what are we getting for this increased state role? Are we getting the more performance that we think we should get? And that really then kind of morphed into adequacy as standards-based reform kind of hit, because standards-based reform gave us standards, content standards that kids were supposed to be taught, performance standards, that I think because we set them, we thought that kids could actually meet those performance standards. And then as John said, the next question is, okay, what does it take to get the kids up to the performance standards? And if we can lay that out then, how much does it cost? And are we, and is the current revenue in the system sufficient to meet those service requirements? So when you begin looking at a state's school finance system, I think you can, and potential changes, you need to ask a series of questions. A, how equitable it is. Even though we're kind of moving beyond equity, we're not ignoring equity. So how equitable is it? How equal is spending per pupil across school districts? When there are differences, to what degree are they related to local school district wealth or kind of median family income? Secondly, how adequate is it? Third, how much would it would changes cost? That is, improvements in the system or changes in the school finance formula, like if Wisconsin shifted from its current three-tiered guaranteed tax base or percentage equalizing formula to a foundation program, what would that cost, and what would be the impact both politically and fiscally, and what would be the impact on equity and adequacy, and to what degree are some changes viable? And I'm going to give you, at the end of my presentation, a few simulations to give you some idea of kind of where we are. Now, in terms of answering the question about the equitability of the Wisconsin school finance system, When I came here in 1993, everybody said the system was inequitable and unfair. I kind of said, well, could you, you know, show me some information, show me some analysis. There wasn't any analysis, so we did the analysis. And we used standard benchmarks. I write one of the texts in finance with a colleague of mine, Larry Pikus. We ran some numbers and said, hey, according to the basic benchmarks, Wisconsin system meets the equity benchmarks. And here are just some statistical measures, the coefficient of variation. The benchmark there is to try to get that number below 0.1 or below 10%. We were at 0.09 in 1966. It's gotten a little better, 2003. The McLuhan Index is the degree to which the bottom half is equal, and you want that number to be 1.0. The McLuhan Index was about 0.96 in 96. It dropped a hair, but statistically insignificant, so the bottom half is pretty much equal. And then the wealth elasticity is the degree we have spending differences. Are they linked to property wealth per pupil? And you want to get that number less than 0.10, and we did it in 93, and we're kind of there, or 96, and we're there in kind of 2003. So that according to a lot of standard equity analysis, we tend to be fairly equitable. I want to kind of phase into adequacy by kind of referencing the Vincent V. Voigt case. We had a school finance suit in the 90s, as you all know. It was an equity suit. Most people, including me, suggested that the equity suit would lose. It did at every level of court, because if people looked at the numbers, all the numbers showed that in terms of the equity benchmark, our system was as uniform as practical, which is the phrase in the constitutional, and the system was found constitutional. But the court kind of laid out an adequacy standard. That is, and it basically was, if you had brought an adequacy case, or if you want to bring an adequacy case, and my guess is at some point somebody probably will bring an adequacy case, the test is, are kids performing at or above proficiency in the courses or the classes or the subjects that you test, and are you providing instruction in the other subjects for which you've got content standards? So my guess is, at some point, we're probably going to get some kind of an adequacy test. And this is, either way, whether you use Wisconsin tests or the NAEP standards, and my guess is over time, our Wisconsin standards will be moderated to the NAEP. This really poses a very large challenge in terms of improving performance and looking at whether we have enough money in the system. And again, as John said, this shift to equity squares with standards-based education reform. I'm not going to go through that again. And the fiscal side of it is, if we, since the expectations are so ambitious, what it means is we've got to go back and squeeze more performance out of the money we have, and we have to get more performance out of the new money that might go into the system. I ask a lot of people. I teach at education administration students in my classes. And I kind of have this thing, we need a double or triple performance. So one of the things I kind of ask them is, you know, what's your strategy for doubling or tripling performance? And I usually get like a blank stare. And it's not going to happen by doing the same thing that we did last year. It's going to take changes, because we're not going to get double the performance unless we change them. I'll give you one example. I don't think many people know about this. Over the past 5 years, the Madison Public Schools has increased the performance of their low-income minority kids in the elementary schools, where 5 years ago only 31% performed at or above a proficiency standard, and they doubled that. So now it's 62%. And they didn't do it by getting more money, as you all know. They changed the reading program. Substantial change in the reading program, and that's almost kind of nobody knows about. They went back to kind of what the research says about effective teaching of reading. There's quite a bit of research on that. And through a long, drawn-out process, because everything we do in Wisconsin and Madison is through a long, drawn-out process, they got people on board. They're all teaching a more common approach to reading. All teachers take running reading records. They are stored at the central office, so if kids move around, as soon as they enter a new school, that school asks for the records. It goes there. All the teachers are trained once they know the reading errors, what kind of instruction to make. They made huge changes in the reading curriculum program. It took professional development. It was helped by SAGE, low class size. They put trainers and coaches in the school full time. But the point is, they made a huge difference, but they changed something, and the big thing they changed was the curriculum instruction program. The school finance shift here is, we got to provide adequacy while we're improving equity. And it, this repositioned school finance, John and I started as kind of being formula designers. Now we have to kind of go to people like Heather and curriculum instruction people and say, what works programmatically? Then we cost it out and come up with a tab to say, these are the things that work from preschool to family involvement, to class size, to school size, to coaching and the instructional coaching in the school, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in order to deploy all of these evidence-based practices, this is what it's going to take to get the job done. And the state role here is to fund that adequate amount with some combination of state and local shares. That's clearly a political debate, how much state, how much local. But the total amount is probably the amount that we'll be stuck with. That includes adequate salaries so that educators, school systems can recruit for the talent they need. It's going to take good talent. You got to recruit it and keep it in order to teach. The districts then have got to kind of fund up schools in terms of some needs-based set of strategies. Then at the school level, they have to figure out what the educational strategy is, all the things that work. And that's going to vary school by school. There'll be some common strategies, but the particular strategies will vary school by school. And then the system's got to reinforce with this with some kind of accountability system to kind of keep the system focused, keep it focused on continuous improvement, and then intervene when places, first to help, and then kind of a tougher intervention when you find places that are struggling and can't move performance forward. So as John said, the $64,000 question, to use a 35-year-old analogy or metaphor, is how much is that adequate dollar amount? And John said there are, four, I would call them four approaches. You've got kind of the leading people who implement three of these approaches here in the room. So will the stars please stand? The successful district approach has been used in several states, but John Augenblick, I think, is the person who's known for kind of starting that that procedure and using it in the states where it's been used. The economic cost function, that is where you say production is the dependent variable and a whole series of variables are independent variables, including expenditures. And Andy Rashofsky, who's here, has done several studies using the economic production function approach. He's done work in Wisconsin. He's done work in Texas. So that's another strategy. The professional judgment or professional consensus approach has been used all over the country. Jim Guthrie, somebody who Karen did talk to, was a potential speaker, has been kind of the major proponent of that. And I've been a major proponent of the evidence-based approach, and that's been used in the states here. So that there are these different approaches, you get different answers. Not to kind of underdo what John and I do, but I think John and I, the evidence-based and the successful district approach generally gives you a lower number than the professional judgment approach does. And the cost function is someplace in between. So that there's a kind of a political economy issue here when you select your consultants to do the study, because you can get high, low, or medium numbers out of the study. And you may or may not want to have multiple studies. Adequacy across the U.S., John mentioned Maryland. There's a lot of studies ongoing. Arkansas just completed a special session. They were in session for 9 weeks, maybe even 10 weeks through the Christmas holidays, responding to a court mandate. A colleague of mine, Larry Pikus, and I did the adequacy study for them. Part of the Arkansas recommendations was to change the level, the structure of teacher pay, as well as the level of teacher pay. This is really the dominant issue all over the country. It is hot and heavy, and adequacy is kind of in the air. I'm going to skip this part on compensation. There is a link, because when you do the professional judgment approach or the evidence-based approach, you identify the number of people you need to deploy strategies. You've got to price it, which means you have to set a salary level that you're going to use, which you think is adequate. And that requires some labor market analysis, some kind of salary benchmarking. And it may require a different kind of a salary structure. This is the structure that was proposed in Arkansas. It's more based on knowledge and skills. You've got several categories of performance, and in order for teachers to continue to improve, increase their salary, they have to, through a performance evaluation of the teachers, show that the performance meets the benchmarks of the next highest category. And if they don't, then your salary is capped at the top step in the category that your performance reflects. We can talk more about that later. I think what I want to do here is stop this and go to some comments on kind of where Wisconsin is. This is a simulation. I know you can't see this. It goes along with our text, but it's the reason I wanted to bring it. It is up on our website. It's on the McGraw-Hill website. It's got several years of Wisconsin data. And you can look at the equity of the system, the adequacy of the system. It answers all these questions. I don't know if this, yeah, this does stretch. When I do work for a state task force, and we run different simulations, this is the kind of front page that we always print out. These are all the equity statistics. So you do a simulation, and then you can conduct all the equity statistics, and you ask a question, and you answer it. How much equity did this particular simulation produce, and is the equity from this simulation better than the equity from the other simulation? And you've got this coefficient of variation, the McLuhan index, the wealth elasticity. We also have an adequacy index that's calculated. There's a couple ways to do that, but we've collected one. It indicates what the cost is. Total state dollars, total local dollars, what the state local share is. And you'll see in a minute, it also indicates winners and losers, which gives you a little bit of a kind of a political feel. If there's a lot of losers, it's unlikely to go through the legislature. It's got to be fixed up a little bit. If there are a lot of winners, it's got a better chance. If there's a lot of winners and it's very costly, then you're kind of stuck between fiscal affordability and winners. But anyway, the data from Wisconsin, 2002, 2003, without accounting for people needs, the coefficient of variation here is 0.79, which is below 10%, and the wealth elasticity is 0.49, which is below 10%, so it looks pretty good. And I put an adequacy number in here of 8,500, in part because that's, we're actually on average spending above that. Our spending share is 9,200. These numbers here are just shared costs, and several people, there have been some studies that have suggested that's kind of about the adequacy figure. So, and on that basis, the adequacy statistic is 0.929, so we're close, but we're not quite there. I'm being signaled that I have 2 minutes to stop. I'm going to take just a couple more minutes here, but I'll be done I'll go through this. Then we put in pupil weights, where we kind of say these are general weights to reflect pupil needs. And we weighted all disabled kids 0.9, that's according to a recent national study, and limited English proficient and low-income kids about 0.2 or 0.25. One of the things this shows is that all the equity statistics go down when you put those weights in. So we don't do as well on equity statistics if we weight all the kids versus their need. We're still pretty good, but it goes down. And this run shows that in order to fully fund these weights, we'd actually need another $385 million in the system. So one of the things it shows is that we're a little shy on providing, through state dollars, sufficient extra resources for low-income kids, ELL kids, and disabled kids. We provide some, but we probably could provide more. Then we can actually, wait a minute. You can also say, okay, we've got variation in spending. Let's look at the wealth of these, of the districts. We kind of group them by 10%. The wealth of the districts in the top spending decile. They have more wealth than the other districts. It turns out they also have a higher tax rate. So one of the things this shows is that our higher spending districts in Wisconsin tend to exert more local tax effort. And they also have substantially more wealth. So we ran a GTB program. The average wealth here in the top spending decile is about $592,000. So we said, hey, what if everybody, we guaranteed $600,000 for everybody? And we ran that. And actually, that's not here. Wait a minute. I've got the 950 in there. Let me just put the 600. It won't take long. It bounces around a little bit. Great computers. And what this shows is if we just guaranteed $600,000 a kid, we could reduce state dollars by $750 million. That would actually require the local dollars to go up by $764 million. So what it shows is that what we're doing, and I think everybody knows this, is we're providing lots of local property tax relief by the way we structure our current aid formula, because we actually, for the secondary guarantee, guarantee about $950,000 a kid rather than $600,000. So that's, we've got a lot of property tax issues kind of roiled up in our school aid formula. Then if we went to a foundation formula, and I think I'll just kind of leave with this one because Karen's really getting angry at me. I just ran one at $8,000 a kid and a required property tax rate of 8. I ran another one at 8,500 and 8.5 mils. One of the things it shows is, when you get this number, this is where Milwaukee is, that in order for our low-spending districts to spend up to an adequate level of about 8,000 or 8,500, they're going to have to raise their tax rates. And even at that, this run cost about $1.3 billion extra. This is a foundation at a simple foundation at $8,000 a kid with a required local tax rate of 8 mils. There's a local tax reduction here of $165 million. If you wanted to reduce the state cost, you'd have to increase the required local effort, which would mean the increase for the low-spending districts would even be more. But my general point here is that in terms of looking at new kinds of formulas, I would urge that all the simulation runs be given to legislators with some kind of a front page like this that gives you an overall summary of what the equity, adequacy, costs and kind of winner-losers issues are, so that they have a view of what goals have been accomplished by that simulation run before you go into looking at the specific winner and losers of specific districts and fixing it up so it's politically more viable. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Dr. Odden.
Thank you, Representative Spencer Black. A lot of interesting numbers, one of which struck me was the distinct trend that Wisconsin's compensation for teachers has gone from above national average to below, and it seems to be a continuing trend based on current situations. Based on what you've seen in other states, what are the, I assume this takes, the consequences of this takes a while to manifest itself. What are the long-term implications if that trend continues in Wisconsin?
Well, the let me kind of add a comment. The to me, this is the big problem in finance in Wisconsin, and we have this ambitious agenda of really increasing performance by a large amount, and that's going to take a kind of a hardworking and a dedicated workforce. And when you, and I think people know this, when you interview or talk to teachers, they're pretty upset and in many cases very angry about the controls that have been placed on their salaries and their salary increase. So we have an unhappy workforce, a very unhappy workforce, and we're trying to kind of have them to get into continuous improvement and to kind of improve results by 100 to 200%. So that's very difficult. So I would say long term, it really erodes our ability to try to substantially improve performance and have all teachers kind of get on the bandwagon to get with what they need to do. Now it's going to happen kind of bit by bit, but I would say to me that is the place to try to figure out how we can intervene. And we're going to have to do it in very clever ways, because you can't just undo the, you can't just say it's just the QEO, and you can't just undo the QEO, because that will spike tax increases, which not everybody will like, either at the state or the local level. So you have to, I think, be creative about it. But it's going to be detrimental to our ambitious expectations for student performance improvements if we don't do something about it soon.
Representative John Townsend. Taking off a little different tack from Representative Black's question related to teachers' salaries, what you showed that we're above national average in terms of the average expenditure per student, but below the national average in terms of salaries. recognizing the fact that within school districts, approximately 85% of their costs are related to salary costs.
Right.
My question is, if we're below on the salary levels, where is the other? Are we high in other areas that perhaps may not be as productive?
Well, that's a great question. The answer is this. We're not high on administrative expenditures. We looked at those numbers. We're probably pretty much at the national average on administrative expenditures at the district level and administrative expenditures at the site level. So kind of saying we have to kind of reduce administration isn't addressing a problem. We in Wisconsin have a lot of people in schools in addition to just teachers. Some of that's because of state requirements. Some of that's because of local choice, but when people from out of state come into Wisconsin and go into schools, they say, boy, there are a lot of people here. And, you know, for example, in Madison, and it spends at an above-average level, but it's typical, I think, of the schools in this region, for every teacher with a regular classroom, there's another professional in the building doing a variety of other things. So it's kind of almost a two-for-one ratio of teachers teaching kids and teachers doing other things that help. They can. This is special ed. This is, you know, English language learning help. This is guidance counselors, social workers. It's a whole series of other people. But the point is, there are a lot of people, and we've done a lot of studies on resource reallocation, and we've actually in a lot of schools in Wisconsin, and those places have kind of done what Heather was suggesting. That is, they've kind of said, well, we've got a lot of resources. Are we using them for the best and most effective strategy? The answer in those cases was no. They've identified more effective strategies, and they've reallocated how they use those people in the schools. So I think we've got huge opportunities here to think about restructuring schools and reallocating how we use those staff people because we start at a relatively high level of resources. And kind of the still kind of hanging question is if they're unhappy because their salary hasn't gone up much and is losing, we still have to do something about that. But in terms of the number of people, we're probably more at the advantaged end than at the disadvantaged end. And I kind of worked in Arkansas. It's pretty bad down there in terms of people in schools, resources. Arizona's starved for resources. I came from California. They're really starved. So I've just worked in, lived in places that where the level of resources are much, much below what they are in Wisconsin. Now, we still might need more, but I would say that we have substantial opportunities to squeeze more student performance out of the resources we now have in schools.
I work with local governments, or we do training of local governments, and we have seen through some of our programming how the local governments or departments within the local governments interact with the schools to help support the education and also some of the problems outside of the schools, like the police departments being informed by the school who's not there, you know, making a run home, police departments putting a police officer in schools to be a liaison, to work with kids. Do you have any other examples of that so local governments could see how to better support their school districts and systems?
Well, there certainly are examples around the country of library resources being shared, of recreational services being shared, of facilities actually being shared, of communities who are building schools in which the public library or the public gym is there. I mean, that kind of thing certainly is happening. There may be other early childhood things too.
I think there are hundreds or thousands of examples. But I also think you're seeing now some big players getting into this discussion. Michael Bloomberg in New York last October convened a summit on out-of-school time, and he had the commissioners of every one of his city agencies sitting up in front talking about their contribution, and the commissioner, the person responsible for education, Joel Klein. The agenda was, how is everyone in this room going to support the success and achievement of kids in the New York City public schools? How are we going to align the out-of-school time supports. That's Parks and Recreation, it's the museums, it's the libraries, it's the out-of-school time programs run through the schools, run by the community-based agencies, run by the after-school corporation, you name it. How are we going to line all of that stuff up to support the learning and development of these kids in our city so that we get different array of scores than you saw with New York against the national NAEP comparison. So I think you're watching now some big-time players put pressure on, in the case of New York City agencies, to figure out how to make this work. Bob Pianta has done a lot of work on the link between early childhood and public schools. A number of people in cities around the country have begun to take up his ideas. I think there's a lot of stuff going on. I think leadership comes into play here in terms of challenging people to say, how are we going to get behind this common agenda in our state, our community, to link these resources and use them to get more performance?
Other questions?
Thank you, Representative Steve Castell. Obviously, the salary issue is the big question as we go forward with school finance. And going back to the statistics that you showed us earlier, I'm still struggling with the discrepancy between our increases in school spending relative decreases in school salaries, even though school salaries are taking up a greater percentage of the overall school budget in every case. So the question is, did your analysis include salaries only, or did it include salary and fringes and all the other benefits that go along with employing someone?
Those numbers were just salaries, but the trend would have been the same on salaries and benefits. If you look over what's happened in Wisconsin and nationally with where the money went over the past 40 years, here's a rough version of the story. From when I went to school, with elementary school, we just had third grade teachers and fourth grade teachers and first grade teachers and a librarian. That was it. So where did the money go? First, it went into art, music, what I call specialist teachers, art, music, PE teachers, to provide planning and prep time for schools and to have specialists in the classroom teach those subjects, which my regular third and fourth grade teachers taught me. So it was specialists. Then a hunk of money has gone into programs for kids with special needs, the kids with disabilities, kids who struggle to learn from low-income backgrounds, desegregation, English language learners, gifted and talented. That's a big, big, big hunk, as we all know from IDEA. Another hunk went into guidance counselors, social workers, psychologists, family outreach. Not much went into raising teacher salaries. This is also true nationally. If you look at relative teacher salaries today versus 20, 30 years ago, they're pretty much where they were. They've kind of gone up sometimes, then they went down. They went up in the late 80s, and then as the internet economy hit in the 90s, they went down again. So teachers' salaries relative to other workers with similar skills or similar job tasks, and there are several national data sets, are about where they were 25, 30 years ago. It's more people in schools who are there to kind of help the regular teacher get performance out of kids. And the conceptual issue, so we have line people, teachers, and I call all these other people kind of the organizational literature staff people. Again, good values. And the issue is, when you look at performance trends, the performance trends have gone up a little bit over the past 40 years, but not all that much. Yes, kids have become more diverse, but the performance impact in terms of the spending increases hasn't been the same. So the issue is, can we use these resources in schools? And I'm just saying, we're at the higher end of that spectrum than many other places for more effective in-school strategies. And in many cases, I think we're finding that we can, but through school restructuring and reorganization, use those dollars differently. One specific example. There's quite a bit of research that large comprehensive high schools aren't the most effective way to organize high school educational experiences. And large means probably above 1,000. We've got lots of large high schools in Wisconsin. And one way to kind of make those resources more effective is to break those schools up into more schools within a school that are kind of more semi-autonomous in terms of instructional programs, pupil support program, et cetera, more personalized teaching environment. That can be done. There are several ways of doing it without any more resources. And you'd probably have, if you did it correctly, you'd probably have a better impact on kids. And we've got efforts to do that in many of the Madison schools, but that's just one of many, many examples. We've looked at schools in Wisconsin that have said, hey, we can lower class size to 15 by reallocating our current resources in grades K to 3. And so we've seen that in several districts across Wisconsin. That was done with no more money. So those are kind of the ideas. Put more money into professional development, like Madison did in improving the reading program. They didn't get more money to do that, but they said that's something that could be done. And so that's what the private sector has done to kind of boost performance, and that's kind of where we are in the public schools, unless somebody thinks by tripling dollars, which we're not going to get, we'd actually triple performance, and I don't think that would happen.
One more quick question here in the front.
Just expanding on Representative Costell's question, if I understood his question, was that in terms of your salary, was that base salary, or was that base salary plus benefits?
Yeah, it didn't include the benefits.
Okay.
But I'm saying the trends would be pretty much the same even if it included benefits.
Well, I guess I would, two-part question on that. One, how do we as a state compare on the benefit package as compared to other states? But the other thing would be is more of a statement, because there's a much broader impact on this, because I just recently, I guess it was maybe last night, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, I read something in terms of the impact on income tax revenue, because what is happening not only to terms of school districts, but employers as well, with rising health care costs, that this is becoming a big negotiating area, and so that the increases in base salary are being held down because employers are picking up are the health care costs becoming a greater part. The point being is that if you decrease or say just hold constant the salaries and you absorb a greater part of the healthcare costs, that is really non-taxable, so you don't pay taxes on it. And so, therefore, we see a depressing effect upon the income tax relationship.
Well, just a couple comments. Public employees generally have a much better benefit package. Wherever you work, local, city, town, state, schools, than workers in the private sector. That's generally true, because it's usually, you know, pretty decent health, pretty decent some insurance and pension. Wisconsin versus other states would be at the high end of benefits. We worked in Arkansas and Texas, for example. They're just getting substantial state and local support for health benefits. I think 5 years ago there weren't health benefits for teachers in Texas. But on average across the country, all the states in the Midwest, in the Northeast, and in the West, it's a full health package and a pension package. Ours might be a little higher because we have, I think, maybe a little bit more third-party insurance health programs than some other places. But I've seen these analyses, and in all sectors, the health costs are infringing on the ability to increase salaries. So that's clearly there. But these trends would stay the same, and we'd still have a lot of people in schools that give us possibilities for using them differently. The numbers might be a little bit different, but the trends would be pretty much the same.
Okay. Our time has come to an end for the formal seminar, but we have quite a few discussion sessions coming up. Let me tell you where those will be. I just want to mention the briefing report that each of you received. There's an overview chapter that talks about these four approaches to achieving adequacy, and there's data, cost estimates using Wisconsin data for three of them. There's a chapter on family involvement in education, what 15 other states are doing in this area, a chapter on the effectiveness of complementary learning by Dr. Weiss, a chapter with Wisconsin data on district revenues and pupil assessments that was written by David Lucknow and Layla Merrifield of the Fiscal Bureau, and a table of contents and executive summaries so you can find what you need really quickly. And we always include a checklist for assessing the impact of policies and programs on families. And in the back, you'll find a lot of local, state, and national resources if you want further information on this. Thanks a lot for coming.